Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Long Beach, California-based jazz saxophonist, composer, and multi-instrumentalist Brian Grace. He opened up about COVID life, his career in jazz, and his new 2022 CD called Long Beach. This EP brings together unforgettable melodies with catchy rhythms and an all-star cast of LA area musicians. For his whole life, he has been heavily involved in the world of all things music. He has played hundreds of live gigs since becoming a professional musician at 19 years old. Early on in his music career, he spent a total of 7 years in various army bands, and the story unfolded from there. Enjoy.
Well, hey, man, thank you for taking a minute out for Neon Jazz today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about Long Beach. And, you know, before we get to Long Beach, you know, it's been a weird time on planet Earth for the last couple of years, and I'm curious how you've been doing, how you've gone through this pandemic as a musician.
Well, that's a good question. The pandemic, you know, kind of threw a monkey wrench in the whole music business in general and specifically for artists that are, you know, playing live. The pandemic for me sort of actually favors me in the kind of artist I am because I'm more of a composer, arranger, and it gave me the opportunity, instead of playing live, I went back to writing a lot on Sibelius and, you know, creating songs for Long Beach. In fact, the EP that I just released is called Long Beach. And most of the music is culled from that particular time of life, the pandemic. And I actually worked remotely, almost nearly exclusively during the whole time with, you know, all these A-list players that are wonderful and friends of mine and at this point. And, develop great relationships with. It's kind of an insular thing from that perspective, in the fact that I got to write a lot more, which is up my alley, and that's my cup of tea. So it's all good.
You kind of touched on the album a little bit. I'm curious, you know, what are you hoping the listener gets from this album?
I want them to hear the disparate styles involved. I really want them to hear what I hear. And that's sort of, I don't know, a sense of a little bit of magic, a little bit of investment in listening. And when I say that, I'm referring to not these quick sound bites that everybody's used to these days. Like, you know, I hear something for, you know, 5 seconds and then we're done with it. I'd like listeners to be more on of my music to be sort of on a journey. I want to take them on a journey. And sometimes that journey will have ups and downs and will have valleys, it'll have mountains, but essentially I want them to feel like they've been somewhere after listening to my music, and that's the goal. And the other secondary goal would possibly be a potential for magic. I mean, I'm not going to write something. I've decided if I'm going to take the time and invest in composing, and if it's worth doing, let's do it right. You know, let's get it out there and make it the absolute best it can be. And that's, for me, it's a process of refining songs over and over. And like, you know, this chord, this minor seventh chord should be a minor major chord. So, and here's why. And then I have to justify it to myself. It's this weird sort of insular process I go through. But I just really would like people to come away with a journeyman's view of wow, I've just been somewhere, and I'd like to check that out again. Ultimately, I would like the listener to, you know, be able to listen again and hear things that they haven't heard previously. So, like nuances, basically. So that's my humble goal, Joe.
Right on. Yeah, no, that sounds like a perfect goal. So let's go back to the beginnings of your life. Talk to me a little bit about how the seeds of jazz got you, kind of your childhood.
I'm going to try to encapsulate this. This is a long story. I'm a Gen Xer. I kind of came from up with albums, and I started listening to my parents' albums. I don't know if your audience remembers what those are.
But, yeah.
And that eventually turned into cassette tapes and CDs. But my parents had a pretty eclectic collection of albums, and that included, Chicago, which for me was a pivotal moment when I heard Chicago Transit Authority. And I just played the heck out of that over and over. And that it really seeped into my consciousness, my musical psyche, made me probably helped my horn arranging. But it all started as a teenager, and I discovered their albums. My high school, weird, it didn't even have a jazz band. I was a sax player, and I was starting to come onto my own within the region. I was in regional bands and McDonald's All-Star marching band, and I started to come on, become a pretty good sax player. But I didn't really know anything about jazz. The only thing I knew was my parents' Chicago records, you know, Summer Breeze Makes Me Feel Fine, Seals and Croft, and things like that. So I picked up on a lot of that stuff, and a lot of it's jazz harmonies. I mean, even the pop stuff and rock records that I listened to. And then I got into the Beatles, and they didn't have any Beatles albums. That was my own personal thing. I'm a sax player, but I love rock, and I love, and this is a lot, has a lot to do with me, probably not having a jazz band in high school. I listened to rock in high school, and I taught myself how to play guitar in high school and bass and a whole bunch of other things. Locked myself in my bedroom for hours and became an instrumentalist. Just played everything I could get my hands on, basically, and it all kind of came natural to me. Really nice, a nice after effect to realize that, hey, this isn't really that hard. So it came pretty easily to me. And then, so after high school, I got a chance to audition. Well, actually, this was my junior year in high school. Let me back up a little bit. I got to audition for the Army Band because, like I said, music was pretty big in my life at that point. And I actually did that in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I passed the audition. So I had my musical life and really my whole life mapped out of me already at 18. I knew I was going to go into the Army, and I had to go through basic training like everybody else. And then I had 6 months of the School of Music in Norfolk, Virginia. And then I ended up getting stationed back at the place I took basic training at, which is Fort Dix, New Jersey. So I just spent 3 years in the Army Band there. And I also got to tour the world on this thing called the Army Soldier Show. That was when I was like 20 years old, so I got that out of my system at an early age. The whole touring around the world living out of a suitcase for 4 months. I was like the youngest guy in the show. It very eye-opening for a guy from Western Maryland. Didn't have any jazz band or anything like that, but I did discover Steely Dan on that tour, and that was a huge leap forward for me. And then I became obsessed with listening to those guys and the Brecker Brothers and just a whole lot of great fusion music. And that really influenced me. And it influences my writing today a lot. I love writing in weird time signatures, and I'm working with guys that can actually do that. The hard stuff I'm asking for, the mathematical stuff in 15-8, for instance, they can pull it off. And that's where I'm at now. I know it's a long story, but there's a lot more to it. We don't have a lot of time, but I just wanted to give you like a kind of a background. I really love rock, but I also love jazz too. It's almost an equal love for both genres.
You know, and I find that interesting, you know, when I think about just how music education works, like Jimmy Chamberlain, the drummer for Smashing Pumpkins, he's doing jazz now. And there's a lot of people that do that whole crossover and it works. So has the stage always been kind of a safe place for you? Have you always felt comfortable on the stage?
I started off pretty shy at first, but once I start playing, I come out of my shell. But it's usually a little bit of stage fright nearly every time I start playing on stage. But I get past that usually after the first or second tune, and once I'm there, I'm in the moment, and then it's all bets are off. You know, I'm kind of totally in the moment, and I'm off and running musically. But I haven't had the chance to play live a lot lately, obviously. In the past 2 years, we know the pandemic has affected a lot of musicians adversely in that respect. But I'm almost more, at this point in my life, I'm probably happier behind the scenes, actually, composing and arranging, and I'm playing sax solos for people on the side at home. So I've set up a whole recording studio in my house, and I have a room dedicated to, you know, recording sax for people, which is cool and fun, and I love it, and I love the engineering side of it too, and producing side. So I'm kind of like enjoying the craft of engineering, driving myself nuts in this insular little room where I create all my music.
Well, I mean, and you know, you've talked about traveling the world. You've been very prolific doing shows. So I'm curious, now that the world is kind of opening up and you have a new album, are you kind of looking forward to getting out and promoting this album and kind of living that life you've done before?
You know, I would like to do that. I need to think about what kind of musicians. I really, at this point, I'm really picky about the caliber of musicians I'm playing with. Lately, I've been, you know, working with some of the best in the business, and it's really hard to go back. And I can't play with these guys live every time. I can't have them be part of the Brian Grace band, jazz band, just because they're always so busy. They're touring. They're doing this. One of my guitar players, Bob Skaggs, right now. All these guys are pros, and they're on the road all the time. Chad Wackerman, my drummer since 2013. He plays with everybody. James Taylor, he played with Frank Zappa, of course, in the 80s. He's just a phenomenal musician and a cool guy. These guys are on the road. I need to just find people of like caliber, or I'm probably not going to be too happy about it. I'm very stringent when it comes to, you know, the quality of music I put out there. And I'm harder on myself than anybody else could possibly be.
So what was the first live jazz show that you saw in person that really blew you away?
Oh, great question. So the second Army band, I went in the Army band for two different tours. The second tour, I was stationed at the Presidio of San Francisco, which was a wonderful place to be in the 90s, in the mid-90s. I got to, you know, play in the city. After my Army band day was over, I would go out and play in the city at nights. But I also saw a lot of great shows there, and one that really comes to mind is at Yoshi's in Oakland. The Brecker Brothers, in 1993, I saw them at Yoshi's. That blew my mind, because I got to meet both of my heroes there. In between sets, I got to meet Michael Brecker, which is my favorite sax player, in my opinion, the best of all time, and Randy Brecker. Bought Randy a drink. And we talk, and great guys, but the music was so inspiring, and I was like, this is the direction I want to go. It's more complex. It's not just 4/4. I mean, these guys are playing in these wild time signatures, and there's a lot of stopping and starting, and that really was a big influence on me, on my own music, too, is seeing the Brecker Brothers. And Steely Dan, obviously, I saw them in 94, and they've been a huge... Donald Fagen, of course, is a genius, I think. He really influenced me, too. When I see them, Mountain View in 94. I think where the live album, the Steely Dan live album, was actually recorded in Mountain View. I was at that show.
Wow.
The one that's, I believe, is Alive in America, is the CD from the, like, 94 or something. Yeah, I was actually at that show. And the culmination of all these... you know, great musical, forward-thinking bands definitely influenced my own music. And I'd say the past three albums I put out, with, you know, Long Beach being the latest one, they've really been exercises in what I like. You know, I'm going to say perfection. I love, you know, striving for perfection, but it's not the end result. I want to make it a certain kind of magic, so it's better to even have a couple of little mistakes in there that nobody else knows about, that only I know about, so it keeps it a little more organic, because the way I write is very strict. I mean, I'm using Sibelius on my computer, and I'm writing out very patiently, note for note, all the instruments for a band, and I'm refining that every time I write. So I'm starting with Sibelius, a song, and I have, like, I don't know, five or six instruments, different instruments, and I start with the drums and end up the bass, and then by the time it's all over, I have a full composition. At that point, I take my composition from Sibelius, and I delete the fake drum part, and I give it to the drummer, Chad Wackerman, who plays with all the other fake instruments that I've played, and that's how the recording process gets started. For all of my tunes, is like, it starts off with a drum track, a great drum track, and then after that, you know, everything kind of falls into place. If you have a great drummer and a great rhythm section, then you've got something to work with, a huge palette.
Well, as Miles Davis used to say, and I just heard this relatively recently, that the first person he ever picked in a band was a drummer. And then he built the band around that.
Oh, absolutely, so, yeah. It's crucial. And I just kind of lucked into meeting him at the Baked Potato, which is, I kind of refer to as my church. I don't have a church, but if there was one, it would be the Baked Potato Jazz Club in Studio City here in L.A., where I've met so many great musicians. I actually met Keith Emerson, who I love his keyboard playing, right before he passed, unfortunately. That's where I met Chad Wackerman. A real quick story about that I want to share with you. I met Chad after I was kind of dissed by Bernard Purdy, of all people. I hooked up with him as the drummer great. You know, Bernard, who's worked with Sly and the Family Stone, all those people in the 60s, Stax, whatever, all that stuff. But he ended up not playing the track with all the nuances that I wanted in there, and I ended up losing money on that, and it just it exploded. It didn't work out. And it gave my sob story to Chad Wackerman. He goes, "Well, Brian, let's see what I can do with that." "I feel you, Brian." And I was like, "Oh, man, that's so nice of you. Can we talk about a recording date?" And he goes, "Yeah, I live in Long Beach. Can you, swing on by?" I'm like, "Oh, my God, that's where I live." so talk about fortuitous. I mean, certainly, if anything was fortuitous, that probably was a moment of clarity where I was like, you know what? So the first time I worked with him, I was in awe. I get a front row seat to watching this guy record drums. And it's amazing. He's just an amazing musician. I don't know. I got lucky working with him, and I've been working with him now ever since. And it's great since I live like 3 miles from him here in Long Beach, California, and I just, swing by when I have a recording.
Yeah, for sure. So, what do you like the best about this process of being a professional musician? What do you look forward to the most every day?
The entire process fascinates me. I love composing, and it's almost like a necessity for me at this point. I'm hearing music in my head a lot, and I'm working out melodies in my head as the day goes by. And if it's a melody that I think is important enough to capture and eventually make into what is called a song, then I will certainly start the process in my brain of taking that melody and thinking of harmonies and thinking of also and rhythms and different machinations too that go along with that melody, and then I start and I go, this is something worthy. It's like there are things that aren't worthy of becoming a song, lying around on my computer, all these bits and stuff. But if it is worth it, and I think it's catchy enough, and I think there's enough potential for it to be really interesting for the listener, as well as myself, it needs to be interesting for me, or it's not worth the time or money of paying all these great musicians that I'm working with to do. I love the process from the beginning of me starting to write drum parts and bass parts and a single sax melody to the very end of the composing process. That's the composing process. After that's done, then it's on to the recording, which is very, at this point, it's piecemeal, and a lot of it's because of the pandemic, but I think I would work in this way anyway. For instance, the album Long Beach, my latest project, I have Chad Wackerman on all the drum parts, and Jimmy Haslip from the Yellow Jackets, great guy, great bass player, co-founder of Yellow Jackets, is also co-producing this project and the EP before this called Stratosphere. So he's playing bass, wonderful bass on both of my latest albums, Long Beach and Stratosphere, as well as co-producing. He'll lock up very well with Chad Wackerman, and then it's like, okay, so now I've got a really great rhythm section. Who am I going to choose to play keyboards and guitars? Sometimes it's me. I'm a multi-instrumentalist, but if I really want it to be to sound cracking, I'll hire Mike Miller, Jeff Richman, guys like that, who I've worked with a lot in the past, who are also, you know, grade A studio players besides Wackerman and Haslip. And a number of great keyboard players like Scott Kinsey has played on a couple of my tunes, and Admiral Ruiz is also on my latest album. He's a Latin Grammy winner. So I've been really fortunate to work with some of the best musicians in the past, I don't know, 5-6 years. And it's hard. Once I've been working with these guys, I don't want to go back. I want to just keep plugging away and continue to write. And I really want people to hear the music, though. That's what's important to me, is that people, I have an audience, and that's what I'm trying to get across here, is like, check out the music, you know. Music is important. It's part of our lives. It's either in the background of people's lives, or for me, it's more of in the foreground. While I'm doing other things, I'm always thinking music. Music is so important, and I think that people have kind of lost their attention spans when it comes to the journey. And I'd like to bring that back in some semblance for people. You know, music's important, and here's why. Here's a journey for you to go on. Let it grab their attention initially, but, you know, something they can listen to again and again and go, oh, wow, I see why he did that. That's interesting. That relates to something he did earlier in the song. So it's, for me, when I'm writing, it all has to make sense in my mind. There are relationships in the song that all have to make sense for me, or I'm not even going to, like, bother with it. So, I mean, I'm always thinking about how to make it better and how to refine it. So it's definitely a perfectionist tendency on my part, and it's just too important to not place a great emphasis on, you know, making the best possible music it can do all the time in every situation, whether it's on stage or for me now, it's mostly behind the scenes, but I do plan on getting out there, you know, now that the pandemic has sort of waned, you know, so.
Of all the musicians that are out there right now, jazz musicians, is there anybody on your radar you would like to see live?
I would like to see Pat Metheny again live. I saw him at Berklee College of Music when I was there, and he was amazing. And I think he's from your neck of the woods originally.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I moved to Lee Summit, his hometown, in January 2020 before everything shut down. So when I would mention that, I've got so many Pat Metheny stories, it's unreal.
Can you give me one? Can you give us one?
Okay, let me think. Oh, there was one guy about a few weeks ago that said that he was in this group of musicians, and there was a gal in the group that said, I'm going to get Pat Metheny to come to talk to us. And this was very early in his career, and I think he was up in the Massachusetts area, Boston area. And everybody kind of looked at her and said, oh, okay, that's great. And about a week later, because she came back and said he was busy, so he can't do it, but he's going to call me back. So everyone was just kind of on the fence, like, how are you possibly going to get Pat Metheny? Well, it happened. And he came, and he totally hung out for much longer than he was slated to hang out, and answered all their questions, played the music, gave them great advice. And I've heard a litany of stories along those lines where he'll come in person, or people will meet him, or they won a contest, and they can take a lesson with him. And every single time they walk away, they are blown away by how humble and down-to-earth, and how he will spend a lot of time with people.
That's so cool. It seems like, you know, the nicest people invariably turn out to be the greatest musicians, too. All the guys I'm working with now are super nice guys, and I think they're just humbled by the fact they get to do this for a living, you know, and that's the way I have a day job, but I also, you know, my goal is to be able to do music so that it pays for itself, you know, so I can continue doing it full time. I would love to be able to write full time and arrange and possibly write for TV and movies. I guess I'm in the right area to do that. So I've got some fingers in different pies around here. You're talking about live playing. I think everybody's excited to get back out there, Joe, and play. And I totally get that. I got the tunes that I really would like to hear live, but like I said, it's going to take time to get the musicians together and stuff. But since I've been out of the loop for like 2 years playing live, you know, it's working people together, it's work rehearsing and stuff like that. But I think the songs that I've got now would really be cool translated live. And there's a lot more we could do with them, besides, you know, reading the music off a piece of paper on a music stand. You know, we could take these things a little bit into Miles Davis weird territory and extend them for long instrumental breaks. Grateful Dead sort of stuff.
So everyone has a perception of you, an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. You have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
Musically, I like to think of myself as sort of an iconoclast. I hear things in my head and I write and I play them. I hear all the instruments usually, and I consider myself like the consummate musician. If I could live, eat, and breathe music for a living and do it for the rest of my life, I would be super happy. And I think a lot of people, that's their impression of me too. Not all people. I think my mother, she's always going to be my mother. She's always telling me to be content in the state that I'm in. But I'm a malcontent by nature. So it's sort of like the kiss of death a little bit, because it makes me cringe to think about. Because to me, it's always about progressing and getting better and not becoming stagnant. And I think I want people to know that I'm very forward-thinking musically, and I'll continue to be. And I'd never like to rest on my laurels. The best song I've done is the last one I've composed, the last one I put together and produced. My ultimate goal is to make something really catchy, yet complex enough to hold someone's interest for, like, say, 8-9 minutes, if that's what it takes to get the point across. And I think my music is definitely reflective of that. I mean, melody is super important, but, you know, the whole structure is important. And making something interesting that other people, I try to keep other people in mind. Like, what would I like to listen to? What do I think other people of like mind would like to hear? And kind of put my writing around that, revolving around those ideas. It's like, what would I like to hear at this point? Is it too cliche? If it's too cliche, I'll take it out. The whole process for me is, I've been doing this for over 30 years now, and I kind of know what works and what doesn't. And like I said, if it gets past the initial stages of, you know, is this going to be something I'm going to want to work on for the next month or two and hire people to play, you know, I'll definitely consider moving forward with whatever musical idea I have at the time and manifesting it to something larger, and which becomes a composition. So, yeah.
That's great. Brian, hey, man, thanks for opening up. Thanks for talking about the album, your life, music. Good luck with everything as we go forward.
Oh, my pleasure. Great talking to you, Joe.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Long Beach, Kansas City, and spots all over the globe, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Brian for his time, music, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit neonjazz@youtube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to neonjazz.blogspot.com. And finally, for everything Joe Domino related, go to joedomino.com. And there, you can donate to the cause of Neon Jazz via Patreon or PayPal. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.